And welcome back. Ron Newman with you on this special Federal Reserve Week here on WBIG. I want to welcome all the people that are listening over the internet throughout the country. And I want to welcome back my guest, G. Edward Griffin, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, a second look at the Federal Reserve. We've got some unfinished business, Ed. Why don't we pick up from where we left off?
Okay, I'm glad you're keeping track of this, Ron, because this issue of what are the true objectives of the Federal Reserve System is a mirror image of the original question of what are the stated objectives. Well, as was mentioned by one of your callers earlier, it's well understood and it's taught in our schools that the objectives of the Federal Reserve are to stabilize the economy and to protect the American people. So let's give the Federal Reserve a report card on that. Since the Federal Reserve was created in 1913, it has presided over the crashes of 1921 and 1929. It presided over the Great Depression of 1929 through 39. We've had recessions in the years 53, 57, 69, 75, and 81. We had a stock market Black Monday in 1987. We've had Mr. Toad's wild ride on the markets ever since the fall of 98, and it just seems to be going down steadily ever since. Corporate debt is soaring. Personal debt is greater than ever. Both business and personal bankruptcies are at an all-time high. Banks and savings and loans have failed in this period of time in larger numbers than ever before in history. Interest on the national debt is consuming half of our tax dollars. Heavy industry has been largely replaced by overseas competitors. And although they tell us the economy's never been better, the real purchasing power, as I mentioned before, the real actual purchasing power and the standard of living for the middle class has been dropping steadily for over 25 years. The national debt is about $5 trillion and is in a vertical climb. And we've had inflation since 1913 at approximately 1,000%. That's taken about 90% of the purchasing power of the American people through this hidden tax called inflation. Now, that's the scoreboard. That's the report card of the Federal Reserve after 80-some years of so-called stabilizing the economy. Hmm. And so I think that any objective observer would have to say, well, the Federal Reserve has failed in its stated objectives. The question is not whether it has failed, it's to why has it failed. And I would say the reason it has failed is because those are not its true objectives. Its real objectives are something quite different. And these are things that the bankers themselves talked about on Jekyll Island, and they wrote about very scholarly papers that were published during the years preceding the Federal Reserve System. The three primary objectives, real objectives, are these. First, to stop the erosion of monetary control away from the large banks in New York. That is exactly the opposite of what the legislation was told. We were told the legislation was about. We were told it was to break the grip of the money trust. One of the primary true objectives of the Federal Reserve was to preserve the grip of the money trust, and they have succeeded in doing that. Another thing was to reverse the trend of industrial expansion by private capital formation. Now, what does that mean? Private capital formation is merely one of those fancy words to describe a process in which people save their own money for future spending instead of borrowing it from the banks. Particularly in industry, this is important. When corporations would hold back a little bit of their profits each quarter, instead of paying it to their in dividends to their stockholders, they would put it into a sinking fund so they would have capital to build new factories or conduct research and development projects and that sort of thing, instead of going to the banks and borrowing money for that. And the banks were very concerned at that time at this trend toward private capital formation instead of debt capital formation. And so they decided, how are we going to reverse that trend? And the answer, you know, is really quite simple. If you want people to borrow, then you just lower the interest rates so that it's so low that a person would be a fool not to go in and borrow money at those low interest rates. Well, the casual observer might say, well, why didn't they just lower the interest rates? The answer is that they couldn't, because in those days, interest rates were not within the control of the bankers or the government or anyone else. They were the product of supply and demand in the marketplace because money was limited in its supply, which had to be backed by silver or gold, and you couldn't just create money out of nothing. You had to go borrow it from somebody who already had it. And if you had to borrow it from someone who already had it, you had to pay them an interest rate that was acceptable to them to lend it to you. So interest rates were always determined by the free market in those days. So the banking industry said, we've got to put an end to this. What we need, they said, is what we should call a flexible currency, which is another hocus-pocus phrase for meaning what we need is money that we can create out of nothing. Now, the trick is not too complicated there. You see, if you can create money out of nothing, you don't have to charge an awful lot of interest on it to show a profit. And so once they were given the power by Congress to create money out of nothing, they could, in fact, then lower the interest rate on it because it didn't make any difference. They didn't have to get it from anybody else. They created it so they could charge any interest on it they wanted and still show a nice profit. That's what they did. That was one of the second objectives of the Federal Reserve, was to be able to stop the trend of industrial expansion by private capital formation, and that they were very successful. They get an A on their report card for that, to the point where today, you know, many corporations are so deeply in debt that they send more money every quarter in interest payments to the bank than they send in dividend checks to their owners, to their investors. So the Federal Reserve was very successful in that second one. And, of course, the third area, which I'm sure we don't have time to go into today, is that they wanted to pass on the inevitable losses of such a system as this. They wanted to pass those losses on to the taxpayer in the name of protecting the public. And they were very, very successful in doing that. As we've seen in later years, all of these bailouts of banks and corporations and third world countries which owe money to the banks, you know, rather than let these loans go sour, the American public is always pushed into a service to provide the money to these corporations, to these countries, so they can continue to pay interest to the banks.
But wait a minute, I think you've lost me here. I was with you up until the point where you said that the taxpayers would bail out and would pay for all these, say, like bad loans to corporations and things like that. And we might not have enough time to go into it fully right now to explain how it works, but basically, how does that debt of a large corporation that's borrowing lots of money, or maybe, let's say, a huge bank, a large bank that gets itself in trouble by giving bad loans that are not coming back, and things like that. How does that money get passed on to you and I as taxpayers?
Well, let's just, any one of those examples would work, whether it's New York City or Penn Central Railroad or Chrysler Corporation or loans from Mexico or Russia.
Or Continental Bank in Chicago.
Or Continental Bank. Yes, all of these entities which we've just named have, in fact, come to the point of bankruptcy where they could not continue to operate without external funds. And so what happens is that the spokesmen for these groups go to Congress and they say, look, Congressman, this is a terrible thing going to happen. If we allow this big bank to fall, it could be the first domino in a series of events that could bring the whole economic system crashing around us. We could have a huge depression on our hands. You don't want that to happen to your beautiful America, do you? So therefore, Congressman, put up taxpayers' funds and pump it into the bank to keep it alive in the name of protecting the people, of course. Always protecting the people. Or they'll say, look, Russia, oh my goodness, Russia is in terrible states right now. Why, they may even go back to communism. Look at all these nuclear weapons they have. We don't want that falling into the hands of dangerous people. And look, they need the money, so let's pump the money into Russia or China or Mexico or some of the countries to keep them from going against the interests of the American people. It's always in the interest of the people, you see. But the product at the end of the line is send the money, folks. Keep the money coming to these countries, to these corporations, to these cities, so that they can continue to pay interest on the debt, and the money eventually goes to the banks. But that was all planned.
But I don't get a tax bill that says there's a portion of that tax bill going to such and such a bank. You say this in the book, this is done, that inflation is the form that this type of taxation takes.
Yes, we must understand that inflation is a tax. It's a hidden tax, but it's a very real one nevertheless, and it's one that no one can escape. And that brings us back now to the question of how money is, in fact, created.
All right, I'll tell you what. Why don't you hold that thought? And I've got three people that are on the phone, and then we're going to put a hold on the phone calls for a while here because we've got a lot of other things to discuss. And, Jeff, you're on the air. All I got to do is ask you to be brief.
Hello, Mr. Griffith.
Hello, Jeff.
I believe you wrote Secrets of the Temple.
No.
No? Well, anyway, it's a book that has to do with Federal Reserve.
Yes.
My question is that I hear a lot of talk about the gold standard, and, of course, I don't agree with that for one reason, and that is because most of the gold is controlled by the International Monetary Fund and the Federal Reserve. And that just mimics the same situation we have with this control of the fiat dollar by the Federal Reserve and the IMF. And so I think it's going to the gold standard would only be going from the frying pan into the fire. I find it very similar to the Federal Reserve note because of the control that would be by the banks. I feel that we should be going to a currency where the Congress would be printing treasury notes.
Okay, I'd like to address that.
Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Go ahead, Ed.
Jeff, that's a very good point. It's often brought up that it's assumed that the gold supply is firmly controllable by the same elitists, the same banking interests that we're talking about. I don't believe that for an instant. I think as long as we give the Federal Reserve and other central banks around the world the power to create money out of nothing, then that allows this very control that you're talking about, because who needs gold or silver when you're using a fiat currency that everybody is forced by law to accept? But once you get that out of the equation, once you go back to real honesty in banking and real honesty in money, and where currencies have to compete on the basis of their intrinsic value, not on the political force behind them, then gold and silver have become the only true, real value-based monetary system in the world, and all currencies then would have to peg their value to that. And there's no way in the world that you can control it. That's the reason that the collectivists hate gold and silver, is because they cannot control it. They can control it only within the framework of a fiat currency.
But I have a question. If it's fiat currency, let's say, for example, Congress and the Federal Reserve were to wave the magic wand, throw up their hands in the air and say, okay, let's go back to the gold standard and let's end the Federal Reserve. And so now the people that have the wealth of this country, they will have the money then to buy into this gold standard, still leaving most of us out in the dark, wouldn't it?
Well, certainly it's true that just going to an honest monetary system is not going to redistribute the wealth evenly among all people.
Yeah, because it's still going to be controlled by the wealthy.
Well, they'll have more of it. I won't say they control it, but they'll certainly have more of it. They have more of the fiat money. They'll probably have more of the gold-based money, too. But the difference is that the chains will be taken off of it, and people in the middle class and in the lower classes will have a crack at it, you see. It'll be honest money. There'll be no political manipulation in it. There'll be no favoritism in it. It'll be fair money. And so a person could actually climb up and acquire, as they did in the good old days, they could become wealthy without having to have everything taken away from them through this hidden tax of inflation.
You know, then you've got, you know, we just did a couple of weeks ago, or about a month ago, actually, we did a story, a five-week series on Truth and Taxation Week, because then you've got the IRS. I mean, years ago, people could keep the money they made. And then when the income tax was formed, they just keep taking more and more and more and more. And pretty soon, I mean, when you've got the buying power of the dollar 90% of what it was over the past 90 years, people just can't save the money anymore.
That's right. And under a system backed by a real honest money, which means gold or silver in the real world, you'd find a phenomenon just the opposite of inflation. You'd find that after a period of time, the same dollars would buy more than they did 5 or 10 years ago. And that would be a result of the increased productivity as a result of technology. And your dollars would buy more. And it's a wonderful thing that the world has very seldom seen it in history, because the temptation for politicians and bankers to corrupt the system for their own advantage is just too great. Historically, we find that this true honesty in banking has very seldom existed for very long for that reason. But anyway, getting back to Jeff's statement about he thinks that the proper form of money should be currency, Federal Reserve notes, that sounds mathematically feasible. You could control the quantity of Federal Reserve notes if you were wise and above temptation. But the fact is that whenever you have a monetary system controlled by human beings, eventually the temptation of that power to create money out of nothing is going to be so great that they will use that power for their own personal advantage or for some private pressure group.
And that's where I'd like to go find out. We're going to have an example. Ed Griffin is going to give us an example of how a loan works. And we'll do that after we take a couple of more phone calls. And Mac, you're on the air.
Good morning, Ron. How are you?
Good. We got to ask you.
Good morning,
brief.
Mr. Griffith. Right. Couple quick points. What part in the 80s when Ronald Reagan was pressured, or I don't know if he was pressured, to lower the percentage of capital reserves the bank was required to keep on hand? And in conjunction with that, and I think you covered this point already, aren't major U.S. banks financially bankrupt due to the plethora of unpayable loans that they made to South America, where we were told they'll never even be able to pay the interest on a loan, much less the principal? Then can you tie that into your wonderful book? I believe it's called The UN and Unfriendly Master, which
no,
I...
No, actually it's called The Creature from Jekyll Island.
He's talking about an older one.
Oh, an older one.
Yeah,
right. Which I gave Ron a copy, and he's got a million things to do. But that was a very excellent book, and I'd like to see if you could tie that in together. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you. I don't know the episode that you're talking about with Reagan lowering the reserve ratio. I'm sure that if he did, he was merely signing a piece of paper that was put in front of him, probably from the Treasury Department and possibly the Federal Reserve. I don't know. But the deeper issue is that the Federal Reserve has the power, the legal power, to change its reserve ratios at any time it wishes. And I don't even think that the president is required to approve of it. So I don't really know what this act was. But the deeper issue is that the reserve ratios are so much eyewash. There's nothing in the legislation that requires the Federal Reserve to have any reserves at all. Right now it averages about 10%. They say that the banks must hold 10% reserves on their books for most of their loans. That depends on the size of the bank and the location of the bank, and there's some variables in there, but it averages out to about 9 or 10%. But what are these reserves? These reserves that they're talking about are not gold or silver or anything of particular intrinsic value. The reserves are nothing but more IOUs. They could be securities, they could be government bonds, and no matter how far you trace this paper trail, it's always debt. There aren't no reserves of any kind anywhere in the entire system, which is a very astounding fact that the system can operate with nothing of tangible value behind it at all, except the raw brute power of government to take money from people through taxes and inflation and fund the whole thing. And your question about the bankruptcy characteristic of most banks is absolutely correct. There isn't a bank in the world of which I'm aware that is truly solvent, because they don't have any real assets, as I mentioned before. Their assets are all debts. And in many cases, and certainly in today's world, these debts are non-performing loans. They should be written off as bad debts, but they don't. They keep them on the books as loans, even though they're non-performing. And then they go to Congress and see if they can't get Congress to vote some tax money so that they can be performing again. You see, that's the trick I was talking about earlier. So yes, I would say most of the banks are technically bankrupt, and the only way they can stay afloat is because they are protected by government.
Well, and I think that this will become clearer after you give an example of what happens to a loan, and or how a loan is created, what happens to that money when I go pick up the check at the bank, and I deposit that in my account, and so on. I love that example that you give in the book. We're going to take care of one more phone call, And then we'll take a break and we'll go into that example that Ed can give us. Joan, good morning. You're on with Ed Griffin.
Good morning. And I have two specific questions that I just want to answer, Charles, in 15 seconds.
Well, let's not do that. Let's just
are you
stick,
sure?
Yes, let's just
okay.
stick with the question.
So my questions are, one, I remember about 20 years ago hearing a speaker, I can't remember who gave it, that there were too many banks in this country and that we had to reduce the number of size, which makes me think that this was a deliberate move by somebody to close down the banks. The other one is, would it be better to go to credit unions than to use the regular bank for banking?
All right, let's give it a
okay, I'll try and be very brief with those. On too many banks, who is to say? I'm a firm believer in the free market. Let the forces of supply and demand answer that question. Let's not force more banks or force fewer banks. Let the public decide how many banks they want. There's always a tendency on the part of the collectivist mind, the elitist who want to control things, is to have a committee and sit down and get a lot of wise people together, maybe 12 wise people, and say, all right, let's decide how many banks we should have and go for that. But I do know that the main banks in Wall Street at the time the Federal Reserve was created did believe that there were too many banks, too many competitive banks. Now, if they owned them all, they wouldn't think there were too many banks, but there were too many that they didn't own and too many that they couldn't control. And one of the purposes of the Federal Reserve was to limit the growth of the banks and eventually to see that they're all controlled by the larger banks in New York. And we can see today that that trend continues. There are fewer and fewer banks. Banks are falling by the wayside and they're being bought up or absorbed into larger banks, and we're finally reaching that wonderful ideal that they had back on Jekyll Island, where there would be very few banks indeed, and they would be primarily controlled from New York. As to credit unions, that's a tough one to say, because it depends on what the monetary system is being used by the credit union. If the credit union is merely using fiat money, it becomes an instrument of the fiat money system. And although the credit union is not allowed to create money out of nothing itself, it nevertheless relies on the supply of money coming from banks that does create money out of nothing. And I would go, if I had to choose between a bank and a credit union, I would put my four square with a credit union, because I think it's based on a lot more honest principles.
All right. With that, we're going to take a break. We'll be back with Ed Griffin, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, after this timeout here on AM 1280. And welcome back. It is 9:33. G. Edward Griffin, our guest. By the way, Ed, before you give that example of how a loan works, and we'll work with simple numbers here, you have your book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, which still is. I mean, you can tell it's Monday around here because I can't say two words together today. It is still available at area bookstores, big bookstores, and if they do not have it, you can certainly order it. It's called The Creature from Jekyll Island. The Creature from Jekyll Island by G. Edward Griffin. G-R-I-F-F-I-N. And it is published by American Media. Now, you, for those of you that have web access at home or at work, if you can get away with it, I want to encourage that. If you have some more questions, and if you would like to read up some more on the Internet, Ed, you also have a very interesting website. What is it, please?
Well, we call it the Reality Zone. And you might guess that the address for the website is www.realityzone.com. So that's pretty easy to remember. It's just realityzone.com. And those of your listeners who may not have access to a Internet, there's an 800 number they could call, too.
All right.
And that's 800-595-6596. That's 800-595-6596. We have a lot of books and videotapes and audio recordings on topics such as this.
Very good. Now, without further ado, you give a very good and yet a very simple example of exactly what we're talking about when it comes to a loan. Let's say, for example, John Q. Public. Let's use myself for example. Let's say Ron goes to the bank and he wants to borrow $100. Now we're using the figure $100 as a simple example. You could apply it to 10,000, 100,000, a million, whatever you want to do here. But we're just talking $100. Take us from that point the minute I walk into the bank.
Okay, Ron, and if you'll forgive me, there's something that happens before you walk into the bank that I think we need to cover. It doesn't take long, but you must remember what the Federal Reserve is here. When they met on Jekyll Island back in 1910, what they created was not a government agency. They created a cartel which was sanctioned by law. This was a group of private bankers who got together, formed an organization to regulate banking, to regulate their own competition, to fix prices, to make sure that competition was controlled, all of the characteristics of the cartel, and they got Congress to go along with it. So we must remember that there were two partners in this cartel. One was a group of bankers, and the other one was the government. And so when you look at the Federal Reserve, you must always recognize that this is basically a cartel. Now, why would the government and the bankers come together and form a cartel like this? It has to have some advantages for both groups, so they wouldn't do it. So now we get to the question of how money is created, and you can see from this process what the advantages are to both groups. The first group is the government itself, and that's where the process really begins. All of the money creation starts at the government. And here's how it works. Let's suppose that the government wants to increase taxes. Government never wants to increase taxes. That's very politically unpopular. The government wants to increase spending without increasing taxes. So one of the best ways they've discovered of doing it is to borrow the money more and beyond what the taxes will cover. They find that they can borrow a certain amount of it from the public, who's willing to go forth and buy bonds and treasury bills and treasury notes in return for the guaranteed interest. But it's never enough for the spending plans of Congress. They need more, more, more. So then, when they have exhausted the supply of money from the public, now they go to the Federal Reserve System and they say, we need some more money to borrow. Now, this is where the Fed finally comes into play. Let's just imagine that the representative from government walked into the Federal Reserve office and he said, well, we need another $1 billion today, please. The Federal Reserve officer opens up his big black book. This is figuratively speaking, understand, because it's all done now in computers. But let's imagine he opens up this big checkbook and he writes a check to the Treasury of the United States government for $1 billion and signs the check and hands it over. And now the government deposits that check into their checking account in the Federal Reserve Bank. And they've got money in their account, and they can now start writing their own checks against that deposit. The question is, where did that $1 billion come from? Who put it into the Federal Reserve System so that they could appear to be loaning it to the federal government? And the amazing answer is, nobody. It doesn't exist. Nobody put any money into the Federal Reserve. There is no account. There's just this big black checkbook. That's all there is. And that money springs into being precisely at the time that it is loaned to the federal government. It didn't exist anywhere in the universe prior to that moment. That's what they call monetizing the debt. In other words, they turned debt, government debt, into money. So it's monetizing the debt. So that money springs into being out of thin air, so to speak. Now, what happens to it next is where it really gets interesting. Let's say that the government takes $1,000 of that money, which was just created out of nothing by the Federal Reserve, and pays it to, a postal worker working for the federal government, and he's got a $1,000 check now. He doesn't dream for a minute that that money didn't exist, the day before. He wouldn't care anyway. As long as it's spendable, people will recognize it and they'll give him goods in return for it. So he takes the $1,000 check from the federal government, and he takes it down the street to his local bank, his commercial bank, and deposits it into the bank. Now, this is where the story really gets interesting. Remember, this is a banker's program here. They dreamed this up, so you'd expect the action to be more interesting here, and in fact, it really is. Now, the banker has $1,000 deposited into his local commercial bank. And let's assume that I'm the banker. I can then go to the front of the bank, open up my little window, and speak out to everybody there and say, attention, everyone, I have some good news for you today. This gentleman over here has just deposited $1,000 into our wonderful bank, and we now have money to loan. And everybody applauds. That's good news because, you know, when there's money to loan, that means that interest rates are low and the economy is good. And a lot of people want to borrow money, so they like to hear that there's money to loan. They don't question where the money came from. So there's somebody out there in the bank that says, well, wait a minute, it's only $1,000. That's not enough for me. I wanted to borrow $9,000 for this car. I would be the banker and say, well, that's quite all right, sir. Don't worry about that. We can loan you $9,000. And he would say, well, how can you do that? You've only got $1,000 deposited. And I would say, don't worry your little head about it. These are bankers' matters. It's quite legal. It's quite possible. And do you want your money or don't you? And so the guy said, yeah, sure, I want my money. So I give him a loan for $9,000. Even though I've only got $1,000 deposited, I can, in fact, by law, in fact, I'm encouraged to do that by the Federal Reserve System, to loan $9,000 that I don't have, which means that the $9,000 is created out of thin air at the point of making the loan. So you see, for every $1 billion that is manufactured out of nothing for the government, by the time that money gets into the banking system, another $9 billion is created out of nothing through commercial loans. Now, the amazing thing is, that is how every single dollar in the United States comes into being, is through that two-step process. It all is based on nothing, and then the amazing thing is that people pay interest on it. Now, we go to the bank, and we borrow money, and we say, gee, thanks for the money. And we pay them interest on nothing. So you see, they're making interest not on $9,000, they're making interest on nothing, which is infinite interest. I think you can see the tremendous advantages of this if you were a banker, and of course if you were a politician, that has its own advantages too, because you can get money at any time you want just by going to the Federal Reserve and asking for it. Whether or not the public is willing to lend it to you, it doesn't make any difference. You can always fall back to the Federal Reserve and get an additional supply. Well, now, that in a nutshell is how money comes into being in America.
Well, one thing I'm still not sure of, and if they have, that bank had $1,000 deposited into the bank, and yet he could loan out $9,000, okay? So the bank said, well, don't worry about that. You know, these are banking matters, and we can certainly do that. This has to do, I take it then, with something that the amount of money that a bank can loan out is because they have to have a certain portion of that loan on deposit. And isn't that figure
that's
about...
That's correct. 10? They call that the reserve ratio.
That's the reserve. So isn't that figure about 10%?
It averages about 10%. So for every, let's put it this way, for every $10,000 in loans, they have to have $1,000 in reserve, which means they've created $9,000.
We're going to have you give another example before the end of the show. I'll tell you what, let's take our final break. We're only a minute away from it anyway, and we'll be back with my guest, G. Edward Griffin. And welcome back. I want to welcome back my guest, Mr. Ed Griffin. You know, Ed, this time is going all too fast. I'd like you, if it's possible, to cover this in a brief amount of time. You tell people in the 60-second lecture that you gave back in 1994.
It was actually 60 minutes.
What did I say?
Well, 60 seconds.
Oh, jeez.
I get to go on pretty
minutes.
Fast. But not
yeah.
Fast.
You can talk fast, but not that fast. A 60-minute tape, audio tape, that is still available from what I understand, where you described an industry where, like the housing industry, for example, a house loan, where you say there is a group of people out there that make more money in the sale of a house than the carpenters, the bricklayers, the electricians, the plumbers, the landscapers, and everybody involved with the building of the house, they make more money than all of them combined, and they never turn so much as a shovel full of dirt.
Yeah, right.
What am I talking about here?
Well, that is actually based on an expression made by Thomas Edison some years ago. He said, and this is his quote, that people who will not turn a shovel full of dirt on the project, nor contribute a pound of materials, will collect more money than will the people who will supply all the materials and do all the work. And that's a rather famous quote of his. He was kind of complaining about this interest on, he really didn't focus on the fact that it was interest on nothing. He was just focusing on the fact that it was interest, and it was very high interest over a period of time. So I ran my calculator on that, and I took an example of a very modest $100,000 house with a $30,000 commitment for land, architect fees, you know, the usual 20% mm-hmm. down.
Mm-hmm.
So I ran the numbers, and I came out that a $100,000 home over 30 years, the buyer would have to pay interest in the amount of $172,741, which is about 2.5 times greater than what would have been paid to those who supplied all the labor and all the materials. And, you know, you could say, well, that's a 30-year loan. That's 30 years of interest. That's the time value of money. Wouldn't you want to be paid interest if somebody took your $100,000 for 30 years? And, of course, that's true. It would be justified on that basis. If someone had saved the money and sacrificed for it and risked it by giving it to you. But this money wasn't saved by anyone. There's no risk to this. What's the time value of nothing, you say? This money was created out of nothing. And I think that $172,741 interest on nothing is, as this lady said earlier, usury. That is the definition of usury. It's interest on nothing.
Wow. You know, I've got three callers that have been waiting on the line here. We're going to try to go through these as fast as we can here without, you know, shorting anybody here. But this has been a fascinating topic. I wish we had about 8 hours. We could do a 5 week or a 5 day show just with you, Ed. You're on the air, caller. Say hello to Edward Griffin.
Good morning. I've been listening, and it's my finding that you don't really need money anymore in a bank or a financial institution. It's not just the power of a decimal point.
What do you mean, Larry? Because we got to move here.
You don't need money anymore. They just give you a decimal point.
Well, it's true.
Or you won't.
You don't need paper currency. That is true. If that's what you mean by money, you don't need currency in your pocket or coins. You can use decimal points in a computer or credit cards or checkbook money. But you do need money. You do need some medium of exchange. When you go to buy a car or a loaf of bread or something, they don't want a decimal point. They want a decimal point of something. And whatever the monetary system is, that's what they want.
And what do you think about the federal government walking away from the mortgage trust funds like the Fannie Mae's and the stuff that they set up? Now they don't want to touch them because they start to see it ballooning and it's possibly going to blow out.
Well, I don't think the federal government should have been involved in that in the first place. I think that's not the function of government, at least according to my view of the world. And so now that they're in it, people think they should be in it, and now they want to walk away, and everybody's mad. I just don't think they should be in it at all.
All right, we've got time for two more phone calls. You're one of them. Good morning. You're on with Ed Griffin.
A quick question for you, Ed. When I look at what's happening in Japan right now, in the 80s they grew up to be a powerhouse, big banks rivaling New York, and now they're in a deflationary depression. The thing I'm wondering is when you start shifting your whole manufacturing operation to low wages, we're now doing the China, Japan is doing China, don't you set up a stage that could ultimately bring the house of cards down through a deflation situation? Because I'm looking at the Chinese wage rate and the fact that they're becoming the powerhouse. What's your opinion on that?
Well, I think you're right. I think that any time you manipulate the markets, whether they be commercial markets, industrial markets, or monetary markets, whenever you use political power to artificially manipulate the supply and demand, you're setting up conditions which ultimately will be a house of cards that could come down somewhere around you. I think when you take the government out of these areas and let the free market determine, you will have very small displacements, but they'll be very small and be very quick as the market quickly adjusts to shifts in supply and demand. You never have any major catastrophes. So I think that what you're saying is correct, but I think that the solution is not for another decision made by another committee with the political power to enforce it. I think the real solution is to get the government out of these seals completely and let the market determine where is the best country to manufacture goods. What is the best wage rate? And not to manipulate it through imports or taxes or foreign aid. You see, one of the things we have in this country, we're taxing producers who are manufacturing goods in this country and giving the money to their competitors in other countries. And that's an example of how governments can upset the natural markets of supply and demand.
All right, we've got time for one more phone call and one more phone call only. That would be you. You've got the final word. Say hello to Ed Griffin.
Hello, Ed. The insidious home equity loan that's being pushed for the last 3 years, what's going to be the ramifications of that with inflation?
I like your words. The insidious home equity loan, yes. They're encouraging people to get out of credit card debt and go into equity loan debt. And most people don't realize what they're doing. Credit card debt is unenforceable. You can lose your credit, but you don't lose your house. If you don't pay a credit card debt, you can, you know, be ruined insofar as your credit record is concerned, but you don't lose your house or your car or your furniture.
So couldn't they go after that if they wanted to?
No. No, that those are unsecured debts in the credit card.
Oh.
But when you transfer that to your home equity, now they have a potential control of your home. They own your mortgage. So if you don't pay, they come and take away everything you have.
Wow.
So people don't realize that what they're doing when they shift over. Of course they get a lower interest rate. Why shouldn't they? Because they put up their home as collateral.
Mm-hmm. You have another website. What is it?
Well, yes, for people who want to do more than just be amazed and horrified at this situation, who want to really make a difference in the world and bring about change, we've launched an organization, Larry, called Freedom Force International. And I'd love to talk about that someday, but I would just encourage anyone who has that bent, that they want to really do something about this, to come and look at our website. It's called www.freedom-force.org. And I think you'd be very pleased at what you see there.
Well, that's great. Now, we have two sites people can go to. The first one you mentioned, of course, www.realityzone.com, and the other one that you just mentioned, www.freedom-force.org. Ed, I got to tell you, this has been a marvelous conversation, and I knew, I was frustrated before I ever talked to you this morning, because I knew that there was no way that we could ever cover 608 pages of an astonishing book called The Creature from Jekyll Island in just a mere, hour and 45 minutes minus commercials. But I think you've given people a glimpse into the Federal Reserve. The book is available from probably all, if not most, major bookstores. All you got to do is ask for it. The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve, by G. Edward Griffin. And a lot of people are worried, Ed. We've only got about a minute left, but a lot of people are worried today. What's going to happen to our economy? Because we're looking at the possibility of going to war this week yet, from what I understand.
Well, I think that whether we actually go to war or not will not affect the economy except psychologically, which of course means it will affect the economy, because a lot of how people perceive the economy is a psychological event in their minds. If people have confidence in the economy, then they'll continue to spend, and the money circulates. But if they get worried, they stop spending, and the velocity of money slows down or comes to a near stop. And then some of the underlying problems with the economy come to the surface. I think that's probably what's going to happen. The economy is really quite weak underneath. The underpinnings, the foundations have been eroded for many, many years by the Federal Reserve System and policies relating to it. And they've been able to cover it up by encouraging people to go deeper and deeper and deeper into debt, and they've been able to cover it up by expanding the monetary supply and creating inflation. But there's only so long you can do that. Sooner or later, you've got to face the music.
You know, you just took the words right out of my mouth. It seems that has collapsed. Am I right?
Not necessarily, because the only issue, though, is even worse. And that is where we ask the government to come in with total dictatorial and the economy. But then you've traded economy for a loss of freedom. And that happens in totalitarians. When the economy gets so bad, people then demand that their government become totalitarian, or they accept it. So the alternative is even worse.
Well, you know, there's a lot more to the culture of Jekyll Island. We've talked about this thing. And I'm curious. Just picking up a copy book, the Culture from Crime, Miracle Made Before, and read it, and take the time. I thought I read it a long time ago. Ed, we are coming right top of the hour here. I want to thank you, and I'd like you to do me a favor, get you on again at some future date.
Ron, I'd be delighted to do that.
All right. And Griffin, so much. It's been a pleasure to be there.
Thank you.
All right. Jedward Griffin, the speaker from Baltimore. He wrote the Culture from Island. Observe, you are listening to AL80 WBIG Aurora, Nate's radio show after news.